I think I might have said the first day that when I was asked to come and was thinking about using this title, which I wanted to write on someday, I wasn't at all sure that it was appropriate to Holy Village. Because I hadn't been here before. Well, I was here 20 years ago with a student group, but I really didn't know what the atmosphere of this place was, and kind of assumed that most people who came here to play, you know, came here to hike and to play pool and lapidary and sculpturing and whatever, and didn't know whether a topic as serious as this would fit into the curriculum. But the response, look at all you folks on Saturday morning, and that the night we talked about God, and the first day I was just overwhelmed by the number of people who showed up, and all of the wonderful comments that people have made. So I'm very grateful if this experience has been helpful to some of you. Thank you for that comment. I appreciate that a lot. I really wasn't fishing for nice things when I opened this up to comments, but was wondering if there was anything that we've talked about or have not talked about that you'd like to ask about or comment on or argue with or whatever for just a few minutes.
Roland?
Yeah.
Okay. Just a comment.
I thought it was God for a
Now I gotta make sure the comment is good.
I thought a lot about the beginning of your session yesterday where you're talking about giving meaning to, giving oneself away to. I really appreciated the way you put that because it's so different from those who try to justify the ill by saying this happened to you so that you would know. We have a handicapped nephew born with spina bifida, and well, it's been the same kind of thing in terms of the sensitivity of our whole family, like people who live with limitations and uncertainty in a way that is more profound than we ever knew. That doesn't justify the pain that that baby had to endure and his parents. And so I guess I just felt the need to hold up the difference because I really heard the difference.
Good. Thank you. Anybody else? There was a story about a boy from Peru who was born without a face. Did any of you see that? Ugly, absolutely dreadful. No nose, mouth, chin. And you saw a picture of him on the TV screen. And it was a story of a medical doctor, I think in Scotland, who had been doing reconstructive surgery on this boy. And I was struck by something the doctor said. It was a very moving 20 minutes. But the doctor said, and I think I caught his words. I try to write down things when I hear them. David has made me a much better doctor. Not technically, of course, but what happens in the heart. This doctor was grateful for having known this tragic boy. There was a young boy in Sioux Falls when I lived there and was teaching at Augustana College who was very severely burned. He had burns over 60-70% of his body. The anticipation was that he would not survive. There's a young man I knew who was a radio announcer in Sioux Falls and something of a community celebrity who heard about this boy lying in one of the hospitals in town. And this young man that I knew went to visit the boy. And he was so so taken with this little boy's pain and agony and the prospect that he would die, Bob, my friend, started visiting the boy every day. He'd go up and see him every day. And he'd bring stuff, and he'd joke with him. Bob had a wonderful sense of humor, and he would tell corny jokes. He told the worst jokes I've ever heard in my life. And this little boy loved it. So he brought a lot of cheer into this little boy's life. And one day, Bob invited me to go with him. He said, I'd like to have you meet. I've forgotten what his name was. I think his name is Roger, if I remember right. He said, I'd like to have you meet this little boy. So I went with him to see him. And I have to say, folks, I could hardly stand to be in the room. For one thing, the room just smelled so bad. The putrefied human flesh. If you've ever known a serious burn victim, you know what I'm talking about. And he looked so terrible. He was burned in his face, and I had a lot of trouble staying there. And then I asked Bob, how is it that you go and see him every day? Why do you do that? And Bob's comment was, I have learned so much from this boy. Bob was grateful for having been in touch with the agony of this little boy. Maybe it seems strange to talk about being grateful for the suffering of someone else. That's almost awful. It seems inappropriate that we should find some gratitude in the suffering of another person. And yet that happens sometimes, doesn't it? Has anybody ever had that experience? And something that you'd like to talk about, maybe? Yeah, please.
Just within the last 3 years, I was interim in the church, and here was a man that had fallen from a hayrack, and that was some 40 years ago, and he was strapped to a board. He was in a nursing home, but also in the hospital. He was always cheerful. And the interesting thing was that you came in to visit, you talked to the people that cared, he was always cheerful. And the people that knew him, his faith was something that was very expressive. And he was in the hospital, and I would say that that's the first time that I ever sat on the floor in the hospital and visited with a patient. But his face was down, mm-hmm. and I was not about to look down on him, but I sat down on the floor to visit with him.
And you're saying something happened to you?
Yeah, this has given me something. Here's somebody that can go through all this, and the people that he has a cheerful attitude, so that I have good reasons to be thankful for mm-hmm. all the things that I have.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that we need to expand on this point. I think you get the point that there is a way in which the suffering and tragedy that happens in the world gifts us. I've often said that I'm a different person now than I was prior to my wife's 4.5, 5 years of illness and ultimate suicide. That changed me a great deal. And I think for the better. It helped to make me far more compassionate toward people who were in great trouble. I spoke yesterday about how it gifted me in terms of giving me a ministry, a whole ministry that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But I'm thinking about it now in an even deeper sense. I'm thinking about what's happened to me as a person from having walked through that dreadful time. Just to illustrate, when I was younger, I often would read novels or go to the movies or something, and have a lot of difficulty understanding why a person in the story reacted the way he or she did. It just seemed to me that it wasn't true to life, the way this person responded, the way the author or the creator of the story was having the character respond. Now I understand that a whole lot better. When, you know, if somebody responds with, I wish I had an illustration to make this clear to you. If somebody responds in a certain way in reading a story, I have much more empathy. That word means to feel with, you know, empathos, to feel with. I have more ability to feel with that person than I had before. So there is an important sense in which I think we can speak legitimately of the gratitude that we feel for the reality of suffering in the world, as strange as that might seem. But then to shift from that to another sense, there's also a gratitude for the suffering that happens to ourselves. And I don't want to say that too quickly either. I certainly don't advise that anybody, when somebody comes to you in pain, that the first thing you say to them is, you should be grateful that you're in pain. And you don't say that, but sometimes people say something that conveys that idea. In time, you will be able to look back upon this, and you will see how you have grown by this experience. Does that sound familiar? Huh? There's kind of Pollyanna about that. That's cheap. And the grieving person, the person in pain, is going to detect the cheapness of that immediately. There's one thing that's so true of people in suffering is that they are very, very sensitive. The antennae are out, and they pick up phoniness right now. I've often said, if you're not prepared to be real with somebody who's in pain, don't mess with it. Stay out of it. Because games don't work with people who are in pain. They'll know it right away. Most of them do. So be real with people and don't come with a lot of Pollyanna stuff that's supposed to help that person past what's going on with language that's going to come across as cheap. I hope that makes some sense to you. Yeah?
What out of that?
It's true, however. You know, it really is true over the long haul that the bad stuff that happens to us can have very rewarding effects. But we don't want to hear it too soon. We had a couple in our congregation in Minneapolis. As I've told you, the church that I served is right next to the University of Minnesota Hospital. And the University of Minnesota Hospital is one of the great medical centers in the world. They don't do any tonsillectomies and appendectomies in that hospital. The people who are in that hospital are there for heart transplants and, really rough stuff. And we'd have quite a number of hospital families who would worship with us on Sunday morning. Half the people in church at Grace on Sunday morning were not members. They were university students, visitors in the university, and lots of them were hospital families. Well, one couple came to church one Sunday, John and Chris Furneaux. And John had been told by the doctor that he had to have a heart-lung transplant. And he was in business in Boston, and he was advised by the doctor he should come to the University of Minnesota. This would be the best place to go to have this major, major surgery. John and Chris sold out everything in Boston. They sold their home, they sold their business and everything, and moved to Minneapolis so they could be right there whenever the heart-lung was flowing in. The helicopters would come down and land on the hospital. They'd be bringing in organs for transplants. And John carried a beeper so that they could reach him immediately, as those organs don't last very long. They have to be transplanted very soon. And time went by. Years went by. I mean, 2, 3, 4 years. And John and Chris were waiting for these organs to come in. Incidentally, folks, there are hundreds of thousands of people who die who might live through organ transplantation, but will die because of the shortage of organs. So if you're not an organ donor, please become an organ donor. And you know how to do that with your automobile license and whatever. That's an aside, but something I really appreciate. Well, one day the organs came in, and the ironic thing is that John's beeper didn't work. And they searched for him, and they found him, fortunately, in time to have the operation. But John's recovery from that surgery was so slow and so arduous. He was in intensive care for almost 6 months. Intensive care. During that time, drugs were used, rejection stuff happened. He went up and down. He'd be feeling pretty good, and then bingo, he'd be gone again. And talk about discouraging. Discouraged. And of course, not only for John, but for his wife, Chris, who stood by, and she was so wonderful. She just nursed him and nurtured him, and she'd play records and stuff. When he was in a coma, she played records, believing that he could hear that and maybe could respond to that. And the nurses and doctors wouldn't do that stuff. One time when I was over there to see them a lot, of course, and one time I was there and the doctor said, there's nothing else for John to do but to get well, because he's done everything else. And he didn't say he could die, of course, but and he was at the brink of death. One time Chris came over to the church, just one block from the hospital, came over to the church to see me, to talk to me about the issue of whether he should have any more care, or they should remove the care and let him die. That's a tough time, right? Well, one time Chris said, and she had a great sense of humor, she said, people say to me, well, you know, this is really character building. And she said, I'm tired of character building. I think I've had just about all the character building I need or I'm able to deal with. So we don't want to get too quick onto this, I'm just going to write gratitude up here, onto this gratitude theme. And yet at the same time, in the long haul, I think we can understand that there are some salutary things that happen to us because of the suffering we undergo. And many people have witnessed to that, of course. Alfred North Tennyson says, sorrow makes us wise. That's Tennyson. There's a Chinese proverb that the lapidary people will understand. The gem cannot be polished without friction, nor can we be perfected without trials. Friedrich Nietzsche is supposed to have said, what does not destroy you will make you stronger. I like that expectancy. What will not destroy you will make you stronger. If we could imagine what a world would be like without pain and suffering, without any pain and suffering, I'm not sure we'd want that world. We'd all be greenhouse plants. We'd all be pretty frail. We'd all be passive. I don't mean we should enjoy our sorrow. We're not masochists. But there is, in the long haul, something about that. John Brantner, the man that I told you about, my good friend who taught in the School of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, I've often said about John that he makes grief sound so good that you can't wait until you have one. And he used to talk about how the grief experience is a kind of focal point in your life. If you could diagram it, you might make it sort of like this. Everything comes together from the past. Everything comes into that experience, and then everything goes out from that experience. But that's the way it comes together, and it goes out from there. John one time said in a lecture, I have a tape of this, I wish I had the exact language. He says something like, anytime that you are in a situation where you are upset or puzzled or afraid or embarrassed or out of sorts, you are participating in a moment with infinite potentiality for growth. And then he'd laugh, that infectious a moment with infinite potentiality for growth. I think about that once in a while when things are really crappy, like yesterday. Here's a moment with infinite potentiality for growth. You've noticed, of course, in the Lutheran Book of Worship that there's a new translation for the Lord's Prayer. And you remember the petition, lead us not into temptation, in the old translation. Who can tell me how that's translated in the new translation?
Save us from the time of trial.
Save us from the time of trial. Save us from the time. I don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like lead us not into temptation either. So I'm in trouble. I wish that they had written that, save us in the time of trial. Not save us from the time of trial. You understand? I'm not asking God to spare me from suffering. But what I am asking God for is that when I am in a time of suffering, I will not be broken by that. I will not be destroyed by that. Save me in my times of trial. That's how I wish we'd say it. And I think that would have a great deal more meaning in terms of our theme this week, it's okay not to be okay. Anybody want to comment on any of this so far? I'll stop then. Yeah, please.
I just need to know if John is still alive, the one with the heart lung transplant.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. No. John did come through that, and he and Chris still live in Minneapolis. In the meantime, Chris has developed a travel agency, and so they've really made their home there. And they've I attended their wedding anniversary, where they redid their vows before the altar, like some people do on their 25th, I think it was their 25th anniversary. You'd be a part of that. And John will never be a really healthy man. I mean, he's dependent on medications, and other organs of his body were messed up by the experience he went through. His kidneys were shot, for example. In fact, his wife gave him a kidney on their anniversary. That's a nice anniversary present. Think about that next time the anniversary comes around. Now, he's really getting along quite well, considering all that he's been through. Yeah?
Getting back to save us from the time.
Yeah.
I can pray that I would suffer from the trials. Isn't that what Christ did, Yosemite?
Yeah, well, that's right. Sure, that's right. We can
that's
pray.
Not saying we should never have, but that's if right. possible, let's not
that's right. That's right. Sure. I agree with that.
The other thing I hear in the word from is that even though I've got them and I'm in them, that eventually I move from them, you know?
Out of them.
Out of them.
Yeah, that's good. Save us out of the time.
Yeah. Get us through it, or through the time.
Help us through the time. Sort of like Psalm 23. We do walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but we don't have to be defeated by that. Well, to move along, I just, under this theme of gratitude, and again, I'm not sure it's the right word, but I just like to hold up for us, this last time we're together, the sense that if you take life as a chunk, you know, the whole bloomin' schmear, there's a whale of a lot of it that's really wonderful. We've been pretty grim sitting here talking about grief all this time. There's a lot about life that's wonderful, at least for most of us. Certainly not for everybody, but for most of us. And there is something to be very, very grateful for, that life delivers itself in the kind of wonderful way that it does. Not only does bad things happen to good people, but good things happen to bad people. maybe more than we deserve. Who was it that, when we were talking about how we greet each other when you say, how are you? And somebody said, who was it? Somebody said, better than I deserve. Who was that? That's kind of nice. That's not to be, guilt-ridden. It's just to say, you know, life is sometimes really better than I deserve. I don't deserve it as good as it is. You folks know the name Al Rognes? Alvin Rognes was the president of Luther Northwestern Seminary in St. Paul. And he had a son whose name was Paul. Al and Nora Rognes are both graduates of Augustana College in Sioux Falls, which is my alma mater and where I taught for 13 years. And I know those folks very, very well. And all of their kids went to Augustana College, including Paul. I have never had a student that I was as close to as I was to Paul Rognes. I don't know whether I felt like his dad. I was too young at that time to feel like his dad. I very much felt like his brother, and a very, very, just a very loving relationship with Paul. Well, I was on leave of absence doing graduate study at the University of Chicago and was having coffee with a couple of friends. One of them that day said, did you hear what happened to Al Rognes' boy? I said, no, what happened? And this friend didn't know the Rognes family at all. And he said, well, I just learned that one of Al and Nora's sons was killed. And my first response was, it can't be Paul. I knew the other kids too. Mike, who teaches at the seminary in St. Paul now, he was in school there too, and their sister, and their other brother, Steve, people. But Paul was the one. I said, it can't be Paul. And I immediately went to the telephone, and I called the Rognes in St. Paul, and I learned. And this is one of the most absolutely absurd things that's ever happened. Or to the world. Paul Rognes was one of the most brilliant students we had at Augustana College. He was a Rhodes Scholar. Remember all the stuff about Bill Clinton being a Rhodes Scholar? There are only a dozen or so Rhodes Scholars every year. The finest, the brightest college students across the United States are given this scholarship. And it gives them 2 years of study at Oxford University in England. Paul was on the football team, first string football team. He was a debater. He was student body president. He was a summa cum laude academician. And yet he never had any kind of, the kind of uppity, pompous kind of stuff that sometimes goes with really big men on campus, as we used to say. Paul was such a unassuming, modest, lovely guy. And Paul Rudness would have gone to the top of anything he set out to do. Absolutely anything. He had been in England for 2 years. His parents had visited him over there during the previous summer. And he was now coming back. And he bought a car in New York, and he drove the car to St. Paul. And when he got out to the outskirts of St. Paul, he parked the car, went across the street to the telephone to call his parents and say, "I'm in town, I'll be home soon." Excited! He left the telephone booth to cross the street and was hit by a truck and killed instantly. How do you fit God into that? His funeral had been about 2 weeks before I heard about it, so I didn't get to hear it. But Al and Nora sent me a card that they were sending out to everybody, a little memorial card. They'd found a prayer in Paul's billfold in his absolutely terrible handwriting. Nobody could read his handwriting. And they had photocopied it in the handwriting, and then they'd translated it, printed it over here. And then I will never forget that Al, his dad, this wonderful, wonderful pastor, theologian, seminary president, wrote on the card, "We thank God that we knew Paul for 24 years. Isn't that great? Many people have said that Al Rudness was never the same after Paul's death. And I would say that that was my experience of him. I didn't have a lot of association with him, but I did have some. And many people pointed out that when Al preached, he would talk about heaven a lot more than he ever had before. And Al Rudness died just about a year and a half ago. And his family talked about how, while he was dying, he said that he was going to go to be with Paul. But isn't that nice? We thank God that we had Paul for 24 years. Maybe what we're talking about is learning how to accept the inevitable. You know the serenity prayer, "God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." Montaigne one time said, "We must learn to endure what we cannot avoid. Our life is composed, like the harmony of the world, of contrary things, also of different tones, sweet and harsh, sharp and flat, soft and loud." If a musician liked only one kind of note, what would he or she have to say? We must know how to use them together and blend them. In a sense, we have a choice about how we are going to deal with the tragedies that happen to us. Now again, not right away, but over the long haul. We can choose to become a recluse. We can choose to feel sorry for ourselves. And I want to be sure that you understand, we have a right to feel sorry for ourselves. in those situations. But we can also choose to feel sorry for ourselves. We can choose not to feel sorry for ourselves. We can choose to find a new kind of possibility out of that grief experience. We have some choice about how we move out of that into the future. I've often wondered, do we really want a just world? When we talk about justice, do we really want a just world? Do we really want a world in which we get what we deserve? The truth is that it's okay not to be okay. And the truth is that I think down deep, what each of us wants more than a God who is just is a God who is a God of love. Isn't that what Martin Luther looked for? Was a God who cared for him? Martin Luther wasn't looking for a God who would treat him as he ought to be treated, as Job was crying out against God. But Luther was looking for a God who was gracious, a God who accepted him as he was. Not okay, but still okay. It seems to me what we really want, when you get right down to it, is the assurance that God is with us. Emmanuel. That's what we want and need. The assurance that God is with us as we go through the buckshot. That we are not alone. And so I would say at our conclusion of our time together that that's what we pray for. That God would be with us now in this moment. I'd like to conclude by reading a couple of quotations from Desmond Tutu. You know who Desmond Tutu is. A bishop of South Africa who is a Nobel Prize winner, Peace Prize winner, and a very, very bright and wonderful man. He gave a lecture about 10 years ago at an Anglican Students' Conference in South Africa. He's a bishop of the Anglican Church. His theme was liberation as a biblical theme. And he says in a collection of his writings and lectures under the title Hope and Suffering, how wonderful it would be if we could relax in our acceptance by God so that we could then be free to accept others, to affirm them, to exult in their goodness and beauty, in their gifts, without feeling threatened and jealous and inadequate, because we too have our gifts, our strengths, because we too are loved forever by God. God created me because God loved me. Somebody has said, God does not make trash. God upholds me in being because God loves me and will love me forever and ever. As I read that, I wish it were Tutu who was reading it in his unusual kind of pierced voice. Or sometime later, he delivered this sermon, or a sermon at the University of Natal in Durban, from which I read this: what a tremendous relief it should be, and has been to many, to discover that we don't need to prove ourselves to God. We don't have to do anything at all to be acceptable to God. That is what Jesus came to say. And for that, Jesus got killed. You see, the religious leaders thought Jesus was proclaiming a thoroughly disreputable God with very low standards. Any Tom, Dick, and Harry or Mary and Jane would soon be jostling with the prim and the proper ones. Jesus really scandalized them. He ate with the riffraff and the scum. The good news is that God loves me long before I could have done anything to deserve it. While we were yet sinners, says Paul, Christ died for us. God did not wait until we were dieable, for he could have waited until the cows came home. I am loved. And that is the most important fact about me. I am loved. And nothing, absolutely nothing, can change that fact. So, it's okay not to be okay. Go in peace.